There are angels from Venus, Neptune, Ganesoft-Mead and many other places working on this. This is a joint effort to save your humanity and to come back and populate the Earth for the next 6,000 years after the 17th of September, 2001. It would be something like the angels coming to Lot before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Noah being instructed to build his ark. Yes, that I understand, but how can we make this fit in with the second half of the 20th century? There are people in your world who can gather large audiences. Your great rock and roll groups, for instance. A live concert of the Beatles could draw 50 to 70,000 people without any problems, right? There is a man in Boston who can give a concert that could attract a crowd of 150,000. Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops. Yes, a single concert of his attracts a lot of people. Take the Rose Bowl, the British rock groups. What would happen at one of these events? After the high draw personality or group had formed, someone would announce that so-and-so is going to be appearing the following month. Maybe along with that person, someone popular would also be appearing. Let me ask you, if someone had come to tell you 6 months ago that Christ would be speaking at Madison Square Garden, would you have gone? No. You see, you could have missed the boat. What sort of preparation do we need to understand when the time has come? You know the rules: knowledge of God, helping and loving one another, faith to understand. You have to accept that Christ is the mastermind of the details of 144 Earth Rescue. There will be no pattern. Remember what the scripture said about the Lord moving in mysterious ways. You just read where it said he may come as a thief. When you accept this, then you love your fellow human beings out of conviction, because you know there was someone great willing to die just to prove the point. What point was that? In order to enter the kingdom of eternal life, you have to be born again. In the Bible it says that these 144,000 will know and understand a tune, a melody, it says a song in Revelation 14:3. Could this be something a lot of people turn onto, like a new fad, a new kind of music, a new belief? Like what? To know Christ is to practice his teachings. What happens if you die before the 144,000 boat leaves? If you have Christ with you already, then your spirit will vibrate evenly. You can die anytime and you don't suffer one bit because you're prepared to take your Anunnas and Ananites into the next plane, the fourth dimension. If a bomb were to explode here now, all we would have to do is channel our spirits to other dimensions. This time, however, our soul would not have any connections with our bodies. When the silver cord breaks, we'll be able to remember all our past incarnations. You and many like you are going to have this built-in frequency of being in tune with the gods. You may pick up thoughts of eternal cosmic revelations. The same kind Daniel, Saint John, Ezekiel, Moses and others had when they were guided by angels in their visions and prophecies. This is a similar phenomena. You're talking to an angel, just as Ezekiel or Daniel were. That doesn't make me a prophet, though. But these happenings repeat themselves. The gods of Ezekiel gave him a scroll to eat and fill his bowels, telling him to go and talk to the people of Israel, Ezekiel 3:1-3. I remember reading his experiences. It reminded me of something like kissing the Blarney Stone. In the days of Ezekiel, your account of what's happening here could have made it to the Bible. Of course, we're not adding to or subtracting from what the Bible says. We're using it as an academic and scientific guide. As far as giving you a scroll to eat, I won't do that, but I will give you this. She placed a metal band around my left wrist. Couldn't tell what kind of metal it was, but it looked like the power bands people had worn during the Vietnam War. As she adjusted it, she said, "This is plain stainless steel. No one would want to steal it from you. You can get these at any store for 65 cents. This one has a special electromagnetic charge that is tuned into your personal vibrations. Am I supposed to feel anything, experience changes? You may have a skin rash for a few days, while the radiation is absorbed. You've seen the copper bracelets people wear for health reasons? Ah. There are also a couple of my vibrations in there. Many times you will hear me think, since this is steel, It will keep away evil forces. What do you mean? Evil forces are also third energy, and are potentially very powerful. Witchcraft, voodoo, jinxes, curses, vamsoft-pyres, all these can be repelled by steel. I was going to give you a steel cross, but was afraid you'd hit me and call me a Jesus freak. You know I'm polite. Anyway, getting back to this big event you might stage. Does that mean the 144,000 are going to be waiting already for some kind of special event? Among themselves, they'll be saying, hey, on such and such a day we'll meet at such and such a place. That's right, it's like having a date. A date with the gods. Hey, not a bad title for a book. Wear this bracelet night and day, and we already have a date. It won't bother you. You can swim with it on, sleep, make love. Do whatever you have to. It'll stay the same. So we have a date, huh? When? It's entirely up to you. We got up then and paid our restaurant bill. Rama walked me to the car. We said goodbye with the assurance that we would see each other again. I drove back to Lima on a beautiful clear day. As I passed the UFO contact sign in Ticlio, I saw a flying disc hovering over me, traveling at the same speed as my rented VW. Under it was a patrol motorcycle, hanging from two cables. I blew a kiss to it, and said, so long, Ramatis. Next day, Saturday, September 28th, I spent with friends, taking care of some last-minute shopping, packing and getting ready to leave Peru. The atmosphere was tense, as preparations for the October 3rd celebration got underway. I was very happy to be leaving Peru. At 7 o'clock Sunday morning I took off on Air Panama, flight number 102 to Miami, Florida. I sat next to Raul Lefkovich, an old Latin American motion picture supervisor, who was headquartered in Mexico City. He was going from Lima to Panama. While in flight we considered the possibilities of coming back to Peru together to release certain flicks. We made tentative plans to meet either in New York or Mexico City in the coming months. After he got off in Panama, I started thinking about what Rama said would happen if I made my images with shape, color and movement. My chances of getting the thought to materialize were good if I continued doing this, acting in good faith, and taking the initial steps to accomplish my goal. This could be a good time to start. Upon arriving in Miami I met with my business partners. They took me to a hotel in Miami Beach. Early the next day, we went to the Miami quarantine station to take some horses to a ranch near Fort Lauderdale. I rented a car at Dania Airport, and hit every existing library in the area, looking for some proof to corroborate my incredible experiences in the Andes Mountains. During the day, for a week, I read all kinds of books on UFOs, mostly scientific reports. The more I read and discussed the subject with people during that first week in the United States, the more convinced I became that there is only a very small segment of the population that doesn't believe UFOs exist. This was encouragement to write the book. After I saw Rama's Vimana hovering over me the day I left Peru, and 1 week's investigations on UFOs, I didn't waste any more time inquiring about aerospatial phenomena. I was convinced that they did exist and decided that Rama was probably legitimate. On Thursday, October 3rd, about mid-morning, while horseback riding, I saw one of the Peruvian horse trainers waving and calling to me, excitedly. He told me that he'd just heard on the radio that Peru was hit by a severe earthquake. He added, jokingly, that the Precisoft-Dent of Peru promised to have the people out on the streets to cheer him, but not quite that early in the morning. I thanked him for the news and sat there on my horse, perplexed. Rama knew it. She'd said she was going to conduct geological studies in the southern part of Peru. Later I learned that the epicenter of the earthquake was in the southern part of Peru. With all that, the only thing I could do was continue with my research. No doubt this girl, whoever she was, knew something I didn't, and yet she was very willing to share that knowledge. In mid-October, we headed for Swanton, Ohio, where a Peruvian horse sale was scheduled toward the end of that month. That gave me a couple of weeks to start the second phase of my research to find historical and scientific evidence as to the teachings Rama had given me. The place in Ohio was a Peruvian horse ranch. I'd met the owner in June before going to Peru. Roy was also an oil perforation man, who enjoyed life, and who seemed like a very nice chap. In the next few days we got to be very close. We spent hours and hours talking. He was the first one I spoke to about my experience in the Andes Mountains. He seemed to listen, made intelligent comments and asked relevant questions. Many evenings we stayed up until 2 or 3 in the morning, talking. I got to meet many of his friends and family. In less than a month, I had managed to read everyone's palm. Everyone was impressed with my accuracy, and how I was able to do it. According to Rama, I had learned to vibrate with the people I came in contact with. I could feel their emotions, their troubles, their fears, as soon as I touched their hands. It was lots of fun. During my stay in Ohio, Roy expressed a sincere desire to go to Peru. He wanted to purchase some Peruvian horses. I told him that if I could be of any help, I was available right then. By the time I left Ohio, I had not only gleaned a great deal of information about God as a third force but also about a potential deal in the works that might be an answer to my prayer to go back to Peru and see Rama again. I was reluctant to go back to Beverly Hills, knowing I might be arrested, but decided to go anyway. I tried calling a few friends, but my telephone had been disconnected. My mail had accumulated all over my desk, 5 months of it. Lots of bills and notes from my creditors. Later that evening, I went to a friend's house, not too far from there. He gave me the phone number of my old gal friend who had gotten sick and tired of waiting for me and had gotten married while I was in Peru. When I called her, she told me that she was leaving her husband and that I should meet her at the corner of Ventura Boulevard and Coldwater Canyon in about an hour. She had left her husband, so we decided to move in together. We found a place in Malibu. In the following weeks, we spent hours and hours, talking, working, researching, and investigating my experiences with Rama. I made a couple of business trips to New York and Chicago during the month of November. I also made one stop in Ohio to get more details on the Peruvian horse buy in Peru. That seemed to be coming together. I started some correspondence going back and forth to Peru. At the same time, whenever in any city, I would hit the libraries in search of more proof of the things Rama had told me. So far, everything was checking out. I was reading all kinds of books, mostly on esoterics and metaphysics. I even went as far as checking out Greek mythology. I got most of my information about the private life of Christ at the New York Library. I screened the print of Jesus Christ Superstar a couple of times and also discovered that the history of the Roman Empire could throw some new light on the psychology and thinking of the times of Jesus, in regard to his teachings, and the prevailing political mood. Riding back to Los Angeles, I read the Book of the Pyramid Prophecies. Rama was right. Every significant date for mankind is written in that ancient stone monolith. By November 25, 1974, I had managed to make 2 appointments that could possibly take me to Peru in the coming months. While in New York, my people told me that going back to Peru was okay with them, but I would have to talk to some of the studio people in Hollywood, then perhaps attend another meeting in Mexico before I could be sent to Lima. I took care of the arrangements by way of several conferences at 20th Century Fox, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Warner Brothers. It was set, I was to go to Mexico during the second week of December. As far as Roy was concerned, on December 5th I was to meet him in San Francisco to take care of the last details on the Peruvian horse buy, details that would determine whether or not it was going to take place. That gave me almost a week to continue with my research and studies. The next few days were spent at the UCLA Parapsychology Department, trying to learn about spirits, incarnation, reincarnation and astronomy. I found that everything Rama told me was very true, and absolutely did not conflict with science or religion. By this time, my friend, Lynn, and I had set up housekeeping in Sherman Oaks in the San Fernando Valley, and I was prepared to begin writing. Chapter 15. Checker the author. I spent the first days of December, 1974, in San Jose, California, studying in some of the Rosicrucian libraries. The Rosicrucians make no secrets of their knowledge and are willing to share it with anyone who cares to take the time to cultivate his or her spirit. Among the many books I found is one called The Mastery of Life, which can be obtained simply by dropping them a card with one's name and address. I was impressed with the Rosicrucians' knowledge of spirit, scientific values, instructions for the use of hidden powers, and their link to Egypt. I found many similarities between Rama's teachings and Rosicrucian theories, which described in plain, simple language the relationship of the soul to the astral planes, spiritual guides, guardian angels, and intuition-the something tells me consciousness. These phenomena, according to the Rosicrucians, are electro-magnetic micro-frequencies which tune a person in with the fourth dimension. On December 5th, after finishing my work in the San Jose libraries, I drove to San Francisco. I was supposed to pick up Roy at the airport on Friday by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a pleasure to see Roy again, especially since he brought news that increased my chances of returning to Peru to an even 85%. We spent most of our day in the city, then drove to a Peruvian horse ranch in Santa Rosa, California, for a meeting scheduled the following day, Saturday, December 7, 317. That evening, Ro and I were invited to attend a Bible reading meeting that was held each weekend at the ranch, on either Fridays or Saturdays. Before going into the room, Roy encouraged me to discuss my Andes Mountains experience and quaint research with the group. By this time, Roy had become very interested in my project and had been doing some checking on Rama's material, and we'd spent hours exchanging information. We even had a few bets regards softening several great world political figures who had some definite characteristics of the Antichrist. I respected Roy's contribution to my book project because he was a stickler for documentation. When he said something, it was always corroborated with facts and evidence. He obviously had good sources of information. I was very reluctant to talk about my conversations with Rama to the Bible study group. Usually, when Roy asked me to discuss this subject with anyone, I refused. I had a message of purpose and goodwill from other intelligences in our solar system. I wasn't interested in making reports of UFO sightings. I also didn't like to be bothered with people's incredulity and annoying soft-functions, like really? Do they have only one eye? Are they really green? There were about 15 people in the room for the Bible study session. Roy said he would be the one to relate my story about the meetings with an extraterrestrial trial. When he had finished outlining my experiences, it seemed only natural that I stand up and say a few words. The room was silent as I gave them a description of the events that had taken place in June of that year. Then the question and answer period began. I was straight forward and to the point. Some believed my story, some didn't. It didn't matter to me one way or another, I was prepared for both attitudes. One young woman, who was a regular of the Bible reading sessions, suddenly stood up and said she didn't believe a word I was saying. "You met Satan up there," she said. "This is all the work of the devil." I didn't know what to say. I tried to reason with her, explaining it wouldn't be possible for Satan to start turning people onto Christ, but my body broke out into a cold sweat. Then I remembered that Rama had said before the end of the year someone would say this openly to me, in a room full of people around a table. The flashback, clear and almost lifelike, seemed to put me in touch with Rama's spirit. She had also said that she would be with me when this event took place. I am definitely relaxed and felt energized by her presence. The hostess, sensed the situation, called the meeting to order and suggested we all hold hands and pray. The girl who said I'd met Satan, kept praying that Jesus Christ have mercy on my soul because I'd come in close contact with the devil. It wasn't pleasant, but I assumed the experience was necessary and accepted it, resolving to put some study into the attitudes which inspired this kind of fear whenever the subject of UFOs came up in my conversations with people. We returned to the hacienda the next day for a luncheon appointment. I had more time to talk to the hostess of the horse ranch, who was an intelligent, well-informed young woman. We spent most of the after-soft-noon discussing spiritual issues. I'd met this woman several times before, but always on business. Today, our common ground was Jesus Christ. She was not only a good Christian, but also very well-read. She gave me a couple of books written by a friend of hers, Hal Lindsey, opening a new source of information about the life and death of Christ, complete with valid reports and historical facts. By the time I left the hacienda that afternoon, I felt only good vibrations. She had planted a new seed in my mind concerning Christ as a man. I would never have guessed that a young woman with all the material things in life could be so down to earth when it came to the teachings of Christ. I left Roy in San Francisco, where he rented a car to do some sightseeing in and around California. We made plans to meet each other in Los Angeles in 4 or 5 days. I had to rush back, as I was booked on the Monday noon flight to Mexico City. My meeting there was for the purpose of straightening out the situation of a certain motion picture business in Peru. This was to be the last time I would get involved in negotiations as an intermediary between the Peruvian government and the international world of motion pictures. Things went smoothly the first 2 days. I was so sure there would be no complications that I called New York and told my partners that everything was working out perfectly. Early the next morning, I received a phone call from the number one man in Mexico City. He said they had decided not to go ahead with the deal. "Thank you very much, don't call us, we'll call you." The deal falling through didn't bother me too much, somehow I'd been prepared for it. By this time, I was making an effort to put into practice the principles Rama had been teaching me. Taking a positive attitude, I decided that I must be in Mexico City for some purpose other than business. I raided a few libraries and museums in Mexico City, searching for more evidence of ancient cosmonauts. I found a copy of the Rodolfo Benavides book, En Noche de los Tiempos, which in English means, In the Night of Time. In this work, Benavides describes astral projection in detail. He refers to God as the eternal thought of creation, using familiar terminology such as the third force, and calling the energy components of the spirit Ananas and Ananites. I also studied some Mayan and Aztec archaeology, calendars, beliefs and myths. All the evidence pointed to the fact that these ancient people believed that they were direct descendants of the sun. I knew there was a place in Mexico called Palenque, at the bottom of one of the pyramids. There is a huge tombstone with a bas-relief carving of a humanoid piloting a rocket. I couldn't imagine anyone could still believe UFOs were fiction when some ancient Mexican sculptor had carved this historical document in stone some 10,000 years ago. I wanted to go to Palenque and see this stone for myself in the worst way. But I had to meet Roy in Los Angeles and someone else in Dallas, Texas, to discuss the possibilities of making a film in Peru about Peruvian horses. I consoled myself with looking at the photosoft-graphs of this marvel, which I had already seen illustrated in one of the von Daniken books. I couldn't miss this meeting. My only hope of going back to Peru was Roy and his Peruvian horse deal. I kept working on successful images, concentrating on the process a step at a time. Roy and I spent the next few days discussing the details of the negotiations, did some sightseeing, and visited many places around Southern California, including a few movie studios. By the time Roy returned to Ohio, the horse deal in Peru was almost reality. It was mid-December, the holiday season was approaching. Roy and Betty, his fiancée, invited me to spend Christmas with them in Michigan. I accepted their kind invitation and made plans to meet them in Swanton, Ohio, a few days before the holidays. In the meantime, I needed to take a few days to straighten out my personal situation in a Beverly Hills court where I had failed to appear for a certain July 15th appointment. Since I was living with a friend in Sherman Oaks, I hadn't been back to my Beverly Hills apartment. My failure to respond to my court summons led to the issuance of a bench warrant for my arrest. I felt like a fugitive. I was on the lam, so to speak. I decided to do something about this problem. I got in my car and drove nonstop to New York to see the one man who had the kind of political influence I needed. I hadn't discussed this particular problem with him, but now it was necessary. I'd thought my court case would be a simple one, with the judge giving me a slap on the wrist and maybe putting me on probation for a year. That didn't seem to be the case. I knew Harold Barton was the only person who could get me off the hook on this one. As embarrassing as it was to tell him about my legal difficulties, he was the one connection that could help me untangle this legal knot. As it turned out, I didn't get to see Harold Barton that day. I arrived in New York on December 19, 1974, but since he hadn't been expecting me, he wasn't available. In fact, I never saw him again. While writing this book, early in 1976, I always watched the 7 o'clock evening news on CBS with Walter Cronkite. I saw a picture of my friend and business associate I had known as Harold Barton flash across the TV screen. The news announcer said he'd been assassinated in Athens, Greece. It was then I learned that his real name was Richard Welsh, and that he was one of the top officials of the CIA. I had been under the impression that Harold Barton was with the International Investment Investigations Organization, the III, as he called it, and that he'd been headquartered in Lima, Peru, for many years. This was another surprise for me, because I had been under the impression that he only took quick trips there to meet me. Reflected back on one of my conversations with Rama, she'd mentioned that the man I worked for was destined to be assassinated sometime around the end of 1975 or early 1976. At the time, I didn't want to believe her, but this was only one of several of her predictions that had come true with amazing accuracy. Upon hearing the news about this assassination, I began remembering back in time to September 1968, when my work with him began to develop. What you are about to read now may clarify why I was so mistrustful of Rama when I first met her in the Andes Mountains. At that time, because of my own undercover activities, I had begun to believe that everyone worked for the CIA. It all began in Copenhagen, Denmark, in the fall of 1968. I was doing some freelance work for a Universal Pictures production, which was under the direction of Alfred Hitchcock. An American couple approached me and asked me to join their organization, explaining in detail what my assignment would be. It seemed easy enough, but somewhat dark and mysterious. I expressed my concern about the secrecy aspect of the assignment they were offering me. They said their work, or our work if I chose to accept it, would be to report events as they happened in certain places in the world where the news is carefully censored before it hits the wire services. At the time, I had just turned 24. I was naive, inexperienced and somewhat idealistic. The proposal sounded intriguing. My recruiters told me I would be serving a nation in its intelligence work. I wasn't that naive. I was fairly certain they were associated with the CIA, and that what they were suggesting involved some kind of spy work. My knowledge of languages made me valuable to them. I remembered, with some amusement, that my college career placement center had suggested such work due to my advanced linguistic abilities. The American couple tried to convince me that the assignment was definitely not a spy job. They told me that a private enterprise, an international company, whose goal it was to eradicate the spread of communism throughout the world, was making this offer. The company, known as International Investment Investisoft-Gashins, was a powerful organization where everyone had his or her own specific line of work, with an attitude of "we don't ask questions because the less we know the better off we are." When I asked for more specifics about the proposed assignment, they told me it would mean reporting on serious journalistic information in various countries. I thought about the offer for about a month. I consulted my mother, a woman who works behind the scenes in the entertainment industry. She listened to my account of the meeting I'd had with the representatives in Denmark. She told me that organizations like Miss Soft-Cyan Impossible and James Bond aren't fictional, they do exist and operate more or less in the same manner as is seen in the movies or television series. Even though I didn't really know whether or not to believe what she was saying, she said something that made good sense. These movies and television programs are based on actual events, taken from secret files after they have been dismissed.